Hey guys, welcome to the Pacing Racing Podcast, the Canadian triathlon podcast made in mind for the age group triathletes. So I'm really excited to say that in today's episode, I get to interview the founder of Training Peaks, Coach Joe Friel. So this is really cool because if you guys haven't heard of Joe before, he's been coaching since 1980 and was also the publisher of the Training Bible in the late 90s in what has since been used by several national sports federations to train their coaches. He's continued his penmanship by writing upwards of 17 other books since then, continuing to make advances in triathlon development and training. Now, Joe noticed in the late 90s that coaches were still using fax machines and writing training plans out on paper, and he came up with an idea of the world's first online training log for coaches to work with an unlimited number of athletes. Now, although Joe currently only coaches a few athletes, he mostly focuses on training emerging top-level coaches on best practices in preparing endurance athletes for competition. So consider him the coach of coaches in endurance sports, and we're fortunate to have him here on today's podcast to talk about his philosophy and methodologies of training. In this episode, you'll hear about how he came up with the features of Training Peaks, including the training stress score, the intensity factors, and how coaches can maximize its use to track their athletes. Now, we also talk about the Training Bible and dive into its training philosophies and methodologies so that we can take these ideas and incorporate them into our training. So we also go over some very practical training advice that we can all start incorporating into our training plans today. So it's an excellent podcast, guys. So sit back, relax, be sure to take some notes on this one because it's full of knowledge, and enjoy the podcast. Now let's cue the music. Today's show is brought to you by two sponsors. The first one is Brown Sports Bike Shop, located in Toronto, Ontario. So I've always wanted to partner up alongside a local bike shop, but I was reluctant to commit because I never found a bike shop that encompassed everything I wanted in a shop until I met JP from Brown Sports. When you want to help represent a bike shop, you want to know you can be absolutely sure you can refer your friends and family and listeners to them and know they're being taken care of in the best hands and getting the best prices. The team at Brown Sports are super knowledgeable when it comes to proper bike selection and bike fitting. In fact, JP is a Retool and IBFI Level 2 certified fitter and will go above and beyond helping you select the right bike for you and go to great lengths in making sure you leave the best bike fit possible. And they have a huge selection of bikes, including an incredible lineup from Quintana Roo Bikes, and they're also the only company in Canada to offer up the 51 Speed Shop products, so it's really an all-in-one shop. So it's not just a bike shop, though. They also have a ton of great nutritional products, swim gear, and running gear. So if you're needing to add something to your triathlon repertoire, then there's a good chance they have it. And I'm currently working with JP now to get my bike fit dialed in, as last season I realized I was losing some valuable wattage and coming off the bike way more fatigued than I had to be because my positioning was way off. So I'll be doing a video of the fitting process when it's all done. So if you want to see that, then be sure to sign up to the Pacing Racing YouTube channel to be first notified when that comes out. And alongside carrying some of the best triathlon and road bike selections, Brown Sports also has a demo room for all the best indoor bike trainers, including the TAC series, the Wahoo series, and even the latest 4i Flight trainer. So if you're in the market for a new bike trainer, then they are also the experts in that area, and they'll help you set up the proper trainer and get you a good price. So if you want to go check them out in person, you can find them at 2447 Bloor Street West in Toronto at the Jane and Bloor intersection, or of course, you can also check them out and see their full inventory and list of services online at brownsports.com. And lastly, you can follow them on Instagram or Facebook by searching Brown Sports. So the second sponsor of today's show is Soul Fitness Canada, who is a premier global name in the fitness industry and has become one of the fastest growing fitness brands across the US and Canada. And as you all know, we're officially in the winter months, which means everything you build up now in training will be paying dividends in your race season next summer. With a few of my big races on the horizon next summer, including the 70.3 Chattanooga and the Daytev Challenge Roth, I'll be ramping up the volume in running, which requires a treadmill that I can put kilometers into worry-free. And with tons and tons of research, I found a brand that I could stand behind for value, their quality, and their service, and I'm excited to say I ended up getting the Soul Fitness TT8 treadmill. So if you want to see my full review video on this, then head to my YouTube channel by searching Pacing and Racing, where I do full detailed outline of how this treadmill works, where I have it set up, and all that kind of fun stuff. But to briefly touch on the treadmill I went with, it's a 4-horsepower motor with 15 levels of incline and 6 levels of decline with speeds up to 12 miles per hour. It has heart rate monitoring with both the pulse grips and chest strap options, and the TT8 features a large running surface, 22-inch by 60-inch, which is awesome, and it has handlebar-mounted speed and incline buttons, onboard speakers, cooling fan, and so much more. So these are all huge, important factors to me when I went looking for a treadmill. And You know, another thing that might resonate with listeners, it's not just about the winter training. In fact, I have a 2-year-old who happens to love her nap time. So I love the idea I'm able to go for a long run on the treadmill while she sleeps. And I think that's a great way to have effective time management for any time crunch triathletes out there. So if you guys are in the market for treadmills, indoor bikes, rowers, or ellipticals for your pain cave, then head to soulfitness.ca/pacing and racing. And again, Soul is spelled S-O-L-E. Now, Soul Fitness is providing Pace Racing listeners a free equipment mat with any cardio equipment purchase from their website, which is a $50 value. So thanks so much to them. And all you need to do to claim this is type pacing and racing during checkout. Now, enjoy the podcast. So, Joe, welcome to the Pace Racing Podcast, man. How are things going?
David, thank you for asking me.
Yeah, no problem. So thanks so much for taking the time today to come on and talk about all things training. And of course, there's so much I'd like to chat about today. But I guess before we dive into all that, let's get the listeners a little bit of an intro here for you. Can you fill us in a little bit about your coaching background and what led you to the creative outlet of ultimately writing training books?
Oh, gosh, it's a long story. I was a runner back in the 1970s. And then some of my employees were just taking up triathlon in the early 80s. So I decided in 1983 to give it a try myself. And I immediately started doing a lot more triathlons and a lot fewer marathons, although there was kind of an overlap. And next, they came into my store, knew I had a degree in exercise. So they were always asking for advice on how to train for whatever the event was. And so I started asking and answered a lot of questions. Next thing I knew, the local newspaper wanted me to write a column for them. And there was a magazine that wanted me to write for them. So I started writing for them, and they were their sister company was a publishing house, a book publishing house. And they asked me if I'd write a book. And at first I said no, because I just didn't have the time, as I had a lot of things going on at that time in my life. But then things began to change really rapidly when I discovered I had a end of my heart and I had to stop training. And so when I stopped training, all of a sudden I had all kinds of time. So I told him I'd write the book, and that became the long process. I've just finished writing the 17th book. So this has been going on since the early 90s, and I know I've got at least one more I want to do. So we'll see what happens after that.
Amazing. Now, it's always incredible to kind of hear the backstory of everything and kind of how where it all led to today. And of course, the books have been incredible and have changed a lot of people's lives, and also their outlook on training. So it's pretty fascinating. And I mean, like, we flash forward to today, and you're pretty much known as the coach of coaches. And of course, we just mentioned you published those several books. And to dig into those topics a little bit more, before we do, I guess let's talk about Training Peaks. Now, I'm always curious, like, how did that all come about, and like, what was the driving factor that made you want to create that program? Because that started in the late 90s, correct?
Yeah, it started in 1999. Back in the 90s, I had assistant coaches working with me. And my son in the early 90s was racing as a pro cyclist in Europe. And by the later 90s, about 97 or 98, he decided to not go back to Europe anymore and race, instead race in the U.S. And he needed a source of income. So he became one of my assistant coaches. And after he began to look at how I was doing things, he realized that we were really not very efficient. Everything was being done by attachments to email, and it was just a mess. So he suggested that he would have his buddy, his best man at his wedding, one of the cyclists he knew, put together something online using basically the same forms we've been using. And the guy did that. That was 1999, and we took it live. And at first, it was just for my coaches. And then not too long after that, late 1999, the three of us, my son, the guy who did the design of the website, and myself, decided to that it was a really pretty good thing that we had here. It opened up for the general population to use just my coaches. And so that's how it became Training Peaks, and it's been that way ever since 1999. You've now got something like about 80 employees, full-time employees, working for the company, and it's grown dramatically since 1999.
Yeah, it's so incredible here. So over 80 employees, like that's spectacular. And I can imagine probably when it started, did you imagine that it would grow that big? in that amount of time? Like that's a pretty huge company now, right?
Well, it's not huge by normal standards, but by my standards, it's huge. We didn't expect to do anything, quite honestly. We were just putting together something that we thought would be a good platform for my coaches to use when they communicate with their clients. And it was really simple when it started. It was just a calendar online is all it was. And the coach could write in the workouts. And when the athlete had done the workouts, the athlete could then write in the details of what they did and any numbers that popped up, you know, times and heart rates and all that kind of stuff. And so the thing has grown tremendously since those days. There were probably only like, I've forgotten, three or four buttons you could click on the entire website back in 1999. There wasn't much in the way of function. It's really hard to keep up with all of them. It takes somebody who really digs into it every day to understand all the possibilities of things you can do with it. But it's a really amazing tool anymore, but it does take some study to get to know it.
For sure, right? So, I mean, first of all, I just want to say, like, it's an amazing app, and it's great to see that it's so widely used and adopted. And so many athletes are using it in their training plans or their coaches. And now, I guess for those who may not use TrainingPeaks yet or are new to it, I guess, can you explain those basic correlations between the fatigue, fitness, and form values that everyone seems to love most about TrainingPeaks, right? So how can that sort of paint a picture of an athlete's overall performance metrics?
Yeah, that's called the performance management chart. It's one of the tools that's offered by TrainingPeaks, really popular. Started out, we have another side app we created called WKO, which is basically, you know, TrainingPeaks lives on the internet. You have to use your browser to get it. The WKO lives on your computer, so you can open it up anytime you want. You don't have to be online to open it up, and they overlap quite a bit in things they do. But that we use WKO it's really very, very serious. So that was the first place we tried this performance management chart with these three functions, you know, fitness, fatigue, and form that you mentioned. We first tried it there, and it proved to be very popular with the folks that were using WKO. So we moved over into TrainingPeaks. And we've done a number of things like that over the years that we started out by trying them out, WKO, and eventually bring them over if they work out. And what it does, it provides a line graph, you know, an XY graph. And it basically looks at, there are three basic things it's measuring every day, but it starts getting kind of complicated after a while. So I won't go into all the details and numbers and formulas and all that stuff, but just overview is it tells the athlete how their fitness is changing over time. So the athlete can compare where I am today with where I was a month ago or where I was a year ago this very same day or anything they want to look at. So if they can look at their fitness, they can look at a measure of fatigue, which gives them an idea of how much stress load they're carrying as they're training. And they can also look at something which athletes call form, which is a little bit more difficult to understand. But basically, form means two things. It means the athlete is fresh, meaning they've gotten rid of fatigue. And number two, they're race ready. They're fit. They're ready to go. And so it tells you where you are at all times in terms of that also. And that becomes the focus of training. If an athlete has a race they're preparing is on race day, they want to come into form. And that's quite open to conjecture as to what that number should be. Every coach, based on the athletes they're coaching, what they want the athlete's form to be number-wise on race day. And then but the idea is that you aim to produce that form on race day. And all it is the combination of fitness and fatigue. So we're going to manipulate those two things in training, hard workouts, easy workouts, long workouts, short workouts, all this stuff. So we're going to manipulate fitness and fatigue. And out of that is going to come the athlete's form on race day. So it's a way of predicting where the athlete's freshness on the day of their event. So I'm just touching the top, you know, the top tip of the iceberg here. There's an awful lot that goes into it. The athlete doesn't have to understand all the formulas and numbers and all that stuff. All you got to do is every day is just upload your day, power meter, heart rate monitor, whatever it may be, and it automatically does it for you. So you don't have to really know any of the stuff. You just data.
Awesome. So that's what I find so incredible about it too, right? Is that, yeah, it's very user-friendly in the fact that the athlete doesn't necessarily have to input any of that data. Like they upload their own information and then it does all the mathematical formulas for them. So you answered it really well there. That was sort of a common question I've received from people is that, yeah, as far as your number values go for fatigue, fitness, and form, it could be different for everyone, right? So you set that up with your coach essentially and figure out what your levels should be, the ranges per se, correct?
Exactly. Yeah, every athlete is unique. And so we really can't have all athletes trying to achieve the very same numbers. It's just not possible. So what the coach's role is, or if the athlete is self-coached, but the role of using this thing is to decide what numbers are appropriate for the athlete and then go about it coming up with a plan. My books talk about how to come up with a plan. When you come up with a plan, the chart shows you what it's going to be on, what's your form plan. Here's what's going to happen on race day. And so it gives you the opportunity to manipulate your training to produce the race readiness and freshness you want when it comes time to race.
Excellent. That's awesome. And that's great for clarification for listeners who use Training Peaks and might not have been familiar with that aspect of it, because I think that's a very important aspect among many things to do with the app. So it's definitely pretty cool. And I'd love to talk all day about it, but there's lots of other stuff I want to talk to you about too. And that includes the Training Bible now. And I want to dive into that a little bit further because it looks like you're on your fourth edition of the Triathlon Training Bible. Is that correct?
I think so. I've got some books that I kind of lose track after a while.
Yeah, there's quite a few.
But I think you're right.
Yeah. So now this, of course, has been a widely adopted book from athletes and coaches. And I kind of want to go over some of your philosophies and the methodologies you use to kind of create these books. And I guess let's start with the training intensities for like, how should we focus on training with proper volume and intensities? Because naturally I think most new triathletes think the harder they work, the fitter they'll get. And that's not always the case, right? Because a lot of times that can lead to overtraining.
Yeah, that's true. There's a lot of stuff here. I do clinics for coaches where we spend well over an hour just talking about that topic right there. So I'm not going to get too deep into the weeds here, but basically the concept is that we're always trying to balance the athlete's volume, how many hours, for example, they train in a week, with their intensity, how hard their workouts are. And if we talk about how hard, we could use all kinds of measurements. We could use, for example, perceived exertion from a scale of 0 to 10. 10 being extremely hard, 0 meaning you're sleeping. So we could come up with so the athlete could tell me how hard the workout was based on that scale. Or we could use a heart rate monitor with zones, and we could come up with how much time was spent in each zone. We could come up with an average heart rate, those sorts of things. We could do the same thing with pace for running, for example. What pace was the athlete running, throughout the workout? Was their average pace, et cetera. And we can do the same thing with power. What was the power the athlete was creating during the workout, and then all the variables that go into power. So all of these things, and what we have to decide is how is the athlete going to measure intensity? So that becomes a decision the athlete and or the coach has to make and decide how we're going to do this measurement. The most basic way is just to use perceived exertion. I get down to the workout and say it felt like it was a 5 on a 10 scale. And then what you have to do is decide, okay, how do I use that to determine how hard the workout was in terms of, also combining it with duration of the workout. So it starts getting rather complicated after a while, but we take care of on Training Peaks. We take care of all that. And in the books, I talk about this also. That we can summarize both of these things, both intensity and workout duration. We can summarize them to one number that on Training Peaks we call the Training Stress Score, it's TSS. So it's just one number that combines both of those things, which is really a proper way to look at it because you really can't separate those things. You don't, when you do a workout, you've got both things going on, and athletes are very good at measuring how long the workout was. You did a bike ride, which was 2 hours long. It's easy. You just look at a stopwatch. Intensity is much more difficult to express, but it can be expressed if you have a data device like a power meter, for example. You can wind up with what we call normalized power. So then we can combine normalized power and duration somehow to tell us how hard was the total workout. Because you could do a really highly intense workout, you know, a 10 on a 10 scale, but it only lasts 5 minutes. And, you know, while it's very intense, the duration is very, very short. So it wouldn't be a very hard workout. Or we could do a 6-hour bike ride at a very low intensity. And, you know, that may not be a very hard workout either. And then we get all these things in between. So it's really confusing. So TSS is simply a way of giving us one number that combines all of these variables, the intensity and duration, into one number. And the formula is quite easy, but again, it gets if you're not really following along with a calculator, you may not be able to keep up with the details. So I really don't want to go into all that. Basically, we're just taking those two variables and we're coming up with something we call the turning stress score, which is a number that tells you how hard the workout was. So the workout could be 100 TSS. For some athletes, that would be a very, very hard workout. 100 TSS could be for a novice, somebody's brand new to the sport, goes out and does a bike ride, which is 100 TSS. That could be extremely hard for that person. Whereas a pro triathlete could do 100 TSS workout, and it'd be like a warm-up. It'd be nothing for that athlete. So the numbers depend on who we're talking about, and the more experienced you become, the more advanced you become, the easier it is to achieve higher numbers. And so what may have been very hard a year ago becomes moderately hard now because your fitness has improved. And so we can measure how your fitness is doing over time by being able to look at your training stress score, the combination of intensity and duration. So then, and that's really what the book talks about are these concepts of being able to talk about in a way that makes it a little bit easier to discuss instead of talking about them as if they're two separate items.
Right. Yeah, no. And that's amazing. So from my understanding of what you're just saying there, that's exactly it, because I mean, you can't get too into the weeds with it because it sounds very technical and a lot of data to formulate all these numbers, but it seems like the numbers almost become more accurate to the individual as they continue to use the app and upload their data to it. So the app starts to recognize what's hard and easier for them, right? Does that make sense? Right.
Yes.
Perfect.
Yeah, it does. It takes about 6 weeks to get enough data collected that the software can begin to look at things and give you some idea of how things are going.
Amazing. No, that's perfect. And then, so I guess looking at that then, like, how can we find that balance in our training of, you know, pushing to the limit and then knowing when to pull back to allow for adequate recovery, I guess, before restarting that cycle? Like, is there ways that we can identify that in those numbers on Training Peaks?
Yeah. The most basic way, of course, would not involve numbers at all. You just ask the athlete, how do you feel? How tired are you? You know, and the athlete can tell you, I'm extremely tired, or I'm very fresh. You know, the athlete typically knows how they feel. And as long as the athlete is getting adequate recovery and is honest with themselves and with their coach, perhaps, we can keep track of things that way. However, we can also look at the app, and the app will tell the athlete how they're doing in terms of that readiness to train. So this we talked about, mentioned a while ago, the idea of fitness and fatigue. And obviously we're always trying to keep those two things in balance. But interestingly enough, they follow the same general trend. So anytime you're becoming very tired, you've got the potential to become very fit. It doesn't mean you are very fit, but if you become very tired, if you rest, for example, especially going to sleep, if you sleep, when you wake up, you'll be more fit because of the sleep you just did and the hard workout you did the prior day. So there's a balance between these two things we're always trying to get. And a good coach or a good, well-informed athlete, smart athlete, will be able to track that very nicely and kind of keep tabs on how they're doing so they know when to back off and know when to give themselves rest breaks. I suggest in my training Bibles that that typically for the under 50 athlete, about every fourth week, they usually need some recovery. And that generally means 3 to 5 days of very reduced training so they can rest. then they can start back into training again. For the older athlete over the age of 50, I suggest perhaps they should be doing this every third week instead of every fourth week. So that way they can kind of stay ahead of the fatigue curve. So they'll get rid of fatigue periodically and then rebuild fatigue. But as they rebuild that fatigue, that is indicating that they've got the potential for fitness also being created. And all they have to do is rest again. As soon as they do, they realize the fitness. And so it becomes this ongoing progression over time where because of the athlete causing fatigue with stressful workouts, TSS is high, they create the potential for fitness. And with enough sleep and rest, the fitness is realized. And so this whole thing becomes this long chart that we can create that shows how the athlete is improving over time in terms of fitness. But it would follow the same trend line as their fatigue, but we have to get rid of that fatigue periodically for this to happen. So this is all the sports science stuff that goes into the charts and such. And again, the athlete doesn't have to understand all this stuff or know anything about the numbers at all. All they got to do is input their data, and the software and the plan tells them what to do.
Excellent. No, that's perfect. That's a really good insight and a great way of explaining it to listeners. So I think that's really cool, and I appreciate that. Now, I guess this next sort of question will sort of relate to more of the training Bible, and I guess just your background generally from being a coach. Now, I guess common age groupers typically, you know, tend to be time starved with things like their family, their job, and so forth. Like, what can or should athletes do if they, you know, miss a workout or a series of workout days? And that tends to, you know, tend to really weigh on people and bother them, right? So should an athlete be trying to make up for lost time with longer workouts next session? Or should they be, you know, just forgetting all about it, getting, consider that their rest day and then move on? Like, what's your thoughts? And as far as like it goes for, you know, your coaching experience and even for Training Peaks.
Yeah, it's that's a common problem every athlete faces at some point. I wrote a blog on this some time back, and basically what I'm trying to describe is how I dealt with the answers to that question for the athletes I coached. And in a nutshell, I could say something like this, that if the athlete missed one, two, or three workouts, you just continue right on as if nothing happened. So you don't try to make them up. You don't worry about it. You just continue right on. If you miss more than three workouts, you know, four or five, six, seven workouts, and by this I mean days of workouts, by the way. So you miss Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, not a big deal. Continue right on Thursday and stuff as if nothing happened. But if you miss Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, we've got a different situation now. Now we probably need to take a look at your training and perhaps step back a little bit. There's going to be a loss of fitness. And most athletes don't think so, but there is a loss of fitness. It's quite small, so we don't need to step back very much. But maybe we need to go back 1 week earlier in training and repeat what we had done the week before. That's going to change everything about the plan, getting ready for a race on a given day. And so it requires a lot of thought and modification of the plan. So it becomes a really complicated thing. But that's necessary at that point. It usually doesn't require a whole lot of change. Usually just going back 1 week will take care of it. If you miss more than 1 week of training, you know, you wind up missing whatever, 10 days, 12 days, 14 days, and so forth. Now we really need to step back a long ways. We probably need to go back into the base period being the first 12 weeks of training the athlete at the very start of the season. And at that point, I would have the athlete go back into what I call the base three, which is the last 4 weeks of base training, and repeat that. And again, that screws up the entire plan. So now we've got to rethink everything the athlete's doing. It gets really complex how we're going to be ready for the race given that kind of a change. And then it gets even worse. You know, say the athlete missed more than a month of training. Wow, if you miss more than a month of training, really need to start all over again. The season just is completely shot. I would suggest at that point forgetting the first race of the season. You're not going to be ready for it. If you want to just do it for fun, don't have any expectations, no longer a Category A. It becomes a Category C probably. And we go back and restart the season. So really, when we miss some workouts, it really kind of depends on how many missed workouts we missed. But I would suggest that the athlete, if they only missed 3 days of training, don't worry about it. Just that's the most common thing that happens. You got to work overtime. They have a cold which flares up for a couple of days, or they've got a, you know, they've got a, some trip has got a, business trip's got to be changed that they didn't have plans for, or whatever. And so when that happens, don't worry about those 3 days. Just forget them and go on as if nothing happened when you get back on your journey on the fourth day. That's the most common situation.
For sure. That's awesome. And so that's actually great to hear. Great to put a, some value to it in terms of like a numerical value, like how many days. So on average, I guess the 3 days is okay. And that's good for people to hear. I think some people, they really panic over the thought of, you know, missing a single day or even 2 days in a row. Right. And that can really throw them off. So I think that's awesome for people to hear. And hopefully that can help some people out. Now, I guess this one is a very common question, and I know this is a very broad question, so I'll see how it goes anyway. But you know, those triathletes out there that have been doing the Olympics and 70.3s that want to jump up to the full Ironman distance, like how would you recommend those athletes, as from a coaching perspective, realistically expect their training volume to increase, and how do they increase that distance safely without, you know, getting into those overtraining boundaries?
Yeah, normally the training volume will increase, although I've known people to do an Ironman on under 10 hours a week. That's certainly possible. It's just that you're expecting to have a very slow race is what that means.
Right.
That can be done. I wouldn't recommend it, but you know, if somebody just has to be doing Ironman, they've only got 8 hours a week to train. There's not much you can do about that, so we just have to do the best we can, but just have to be also be realistic that it probably means you're going to be out there for a very long time. I spend a lot of time walking on the last leg of the race and so forth.
Right.
So the bottom line is, you want to move up from like 70.3 to Ironman. I'd be prepared to realize an increase in returning volume. Got to be realistic about that. I would suggest probably no more than around 10% of what you've been doing would be realistic. You jump at more than 10%, the risk goes pretty high, that you'll be injured or you'll be overtrained or something will happen that's not good. So it becomes very difficult at that point. And then we have to always have very realistic expectations. When I've coached people who are doing their first Ironman, the goal always, number one goal always, is to finish the race. That's the number one goal, first Ironman. I coached a pro one time who was doing his first Ironman, and that was the goal. I didn't care about his time, didn't care about anything. I just wanted to finish the race. Once he had done that, then we could go on and try it on at a faster level and see what we can accomplish. But the first time out, just finish the race. Nobody realizes how difficult it is, including the pros, until you actually do it. Watch it on TV and they show the pros out there, you know, running 6 minute pace toward the end of the race. It looks like it's pretty easy, but they don't show you the people who are out there struggling just to make it to the finish line. It's going to take 15, 16 hours and they're experiencing a really tough day. So you just got to be prepared to just finish the race, which means you can't get carried away with volume. You can't get carried away with how fast I'm going to go. You can't really set up any goals in terms of what my splits are going to be or anything like that. Just finish the race is my advice to people who are doing it for the first time.
Awesome. No, that's perfect. And that's spot on too. I think that's a really sound piece of advice. And I think a lot of people can definitely take that and, you know, almost feel a little bit better about their training, right? To not set those high expectations for their first Ironman and be realistic about it. So I think that's awesome. Hit the nail on the head there. So now I want to talk about recovery and of course, feeling your body as a triathlete, because I know you were a co-publisher on a paleo diet book and I was kind of curious to see your take on this on for the iron distance athletes. How should they be focusing on eating? I know everyone's going to be different, but general rule of thumbs to, you know, fuel your body properly. Is it like something like the paleo diet is something that you recommend?
I would recommend primarily that the athlete move toward a diet which includes a higher intake of fat, a lower intake of carbohydrate if they're training for an Ironman distance race. I think the longer the race is, the more benefit the athlete gets from eating a high-fat diet. Whereas for very short races, sprint distance, Olympic distance races, you're probably better off on a high-carbohydrate diet for that kind of distance. So it kind of depends. And it also depends on the athlete. If you're going to start using a high-fat diet because you're turning for Ironman, then you really need to change your chronic diet starting many, many weeks, months perhaps, actually better, months in advance of the race, changing over to a high-fat diet and reducing the carbohydrates you're eating. That will cause your body to start using fat for fuel primarily and become more sparing of carbohydrate, form of glycogen, glucose that you have in your body. So that on race day, when you get to that point several weeks, even months later, you don't have to take in all that food during the race. The biggest problem I've seen with athletes over the years doing Ironman is that they wind up trying to get so much carbohydrate into their stomachs during the race that they wind up with the stomach shutting down. They become nauseous. They're off the bike, throwing up. They're just having a really tough time. And it's because they're trying to get all this carbohydrate in. It's very difficult for your body to process carbohydrate and also produce a high, relatively high intensity for long duration. So that's what I would advise people to do, is just move toward a higher fat diet if you're going to do a long distance race like that.
Perfect. Yeah, no, that's good. And I've heard more and more these days, a lot of top coaches and a lot of people who have spent many years kind of doing studies on Ironmans, that it is the high fat, low carb approach is sort of the better way of going. So now, in terms of this, is this something you recommend athletes go and see a nutritionist for? Because I can imagine it's going to be pretty technical and there's no just standardized numbers of fats and carb ratios and stuff, right?
Well, yeah, I think it's always good to get advice from somebody that knows more about that sort of thing. The problem is that I'm afraid a lot of nutritionists, registered dietitians, are for whatever reason extremely opposed to anybody eating fat, especially at high levels. And so the chances are you're going to wind up with somebody who's just going to try to talk you out of it, who knows nothing about the sport,
right,
but knows an awful lot about how to eat a high carbohydrate diet. I'm afraid that many, many of the people who give advice in this area are really stuck in the 1980s, that they're stuck with this idea they've got to have high carbohydrate all the time if you're an athlete. And again, while that's true while you're doing shorter distance races, doing 5Ks, 10Ks, half marathons, Olympic distance, sprint distance races, that's probably true. But as you move into longer distance, longer duration events, you're really going to benefit from having higher fat. So you've got to be very selective in the person you find. The person needs to understand why this is beneficial for that type of event so they can give you good advice. So you need to ask questions and do a lot of searching before you find the person to help you with that.
For sure. No, perfect. That's good. Yeah. And you are right. Now that you mention that, you're right. If you go to a certain nutritionist who doesn't understand the concepts of Ironman and was involved in it, they might almost deter you away from it or think the idea they won't see how it adds up. So that's good. And this could be an all day topic as well. So again, just kind of looking for your general opinion on it. Does it matter for an athlete to have either plant-based diet or incorporating meat? Like does that make any difference in a triathlete, training for an Ironman, or are we more focusing on the fuel sources themselves, like carbs and fats?
Well, the starting place is carbs and fats. And then that obviously breaks down to what does that mean in terms of what do I eat? I'd highly recommend that once we've made that decision, the athlete eat from a broad range of foods, which we include vegetables and fruits and animal products, fairly wide range. We're just being somewhat selective in what types and which subcategories of those foods we're eating, so we get a lot more fat in our diet. But there have been a lot of athletes who've done very well on vegetarian diets. I think they're small in number, but there's certainly been a lot of people who've done it. So I wouldn't rule out the fact that somebody could do it, but I think it becomes just more difficult to get the diet right. If we now change to a high fat diet and we've also got to eat a diet which has no animal products in it, that complicates the thing even more. And so we're starting to restrict an awful lot of things in the diet. And that always concerns me, start restricting a gigantic amount of things we're eating. So it's a very individualized matter. I can't give an answer that works for everybody. So you just have to do some research for yourself, some talks with people who know more than an athlete does, and then make a call.
Perfect. No, that's excellent. Actually, the answer that you gave there is kind of on point there too, right? Like, I think that's a great way of explaining that, and also keeping it generic to let people know that at the end of the day, yeah, they have to make that decision as an individual and, you know, seek the proper consultation on it. So that's good. And now I guess moving away from the nutrition and just kind of talk about training metrics to sort of end off the end of this podcast here. When it comes to things like heart rate zone training, is that something that age groupers should incorporate into the training, or is that something that you've used with athletes or have talked to with coaches? Especially, I guess, when you look at the prime example of people like Mark Allen, who trained immensely in zone two over those years.
Yeah. I've used heart rate certainly with the athletes I've coached. I quite honestly like to use all the metrics. I like to use heart rate. I like to use power. I like to use pace. The more data I have as a coach, the better I can coach the athlete. The more I know what's going on with the athlete. With a self-coached athlete, that becomes overwhelming after a while if you're trying to keep track of all of these different metrics. So heart rate is a good option. One has to realize that what we're measuring when you measure heart rate, if we're measuring heart rate, let's take a runner. We can measure heart rate and or pace, how fast they're running. We can measure both those things. They aren't telling us the same thing. They're telling us two separate things, actually. Heart rate is telling us about effort, how hard the athlete is working. It's not telling us anything at all about performance. Pace tells us about performance. If I want to predict the outcome of a 10K race, you know, what's the key question I would ask every person in the start of the race? So I could wind up, you know, predicting how the race is going to come out. The key question would be, how fast do you run a 10K? I wouldn't ask anything about the heart rate. I don't care what their max heart rate is, what their lactate threshold heart rate is, what their resting heart rate is, or anything else. They won't tell me anything at all about performance. It will only tell me about effort. But pace, speed, tells me about performance. So the question becomes, if I'm an athlete and I want to measure something in my training, what do I want to measure? Do I want to measure effort, how hard I'm working, or do I want to measure performance, what I'm accomplishing? They're not the same thing. Having both is extremely valuable information, but becomes much more complex in trying to determine what it means. But it's quite possible you could use one or the other and simplify it by setting up zones. So I could have heart rate zones, and then I could have my athlete train in a certain ways that distributes their training time over all these, let's say, five zones. The way which has been shown in the last almost 20 years, I guess actually about 15 or 17 years, is this idea of polarized training, so that we spend something like 80% of our workouts are done below the aerobic threshold, which generally means around zone two or lower. And about 20% of our workouts are done at above the anaerobic threshold, which is a relatively high effort. On that scale of 0 to 10, it's about a 7. So we could have try and distribute intensity that way by looking at 80-20 polarized training. That would be one way of looking at it. You mentioned Mark doing a lot of time zone two. I've done that with my athletes. Also continue to believe it's a very good way of building aerobic fitness down around, you know, like around a 3 or 4 intensity on a 10 scale. Doing lots of workouts in that area will give you that 80%. Excuse me, but it also builds really good aerobic fitness, which is what triathlon is all about. It's an aerobic sport. It's not an anaerobic sport. It's an aerobic sport. The athlete in an Ironman triathlon, if they go anaerobic, has got a real problem facing them. Probably not going to finish. So they're going to be aerobic for the entire time, however many hours that may be. So the athletes have become very, very fit aerobically. And the athletes think it's too easy, but quite honestly, it's the best thing they can do when they're doing long course racing like Ironman.
Perfect. Awesome. I really appreciate that. I think that's an awesome advice out there. And, you know, it's that key that people always seem to forget is the aerobic versus anaerobic training. So That's huge, right? Whether, you know, following that 80-20 rule, I know that's been a common thing thrown out there, and I can definitely see the benefits of that. So I think that's really cool. And we've talked about training, recovery, nutrition, and metrics, but just one of the last things I want to touch base on was mindset and, you know, proper mindset in triathlon training. Now, it's funny, I was actually just talking to Matt McElroy just before this podcast, and we were talking about his mindset training, because now him, and actually it seems like a lot of ITU triathletes are getting on board with sports psychologists to, you know, enhance their mindset training. And I was just kind of curious from your take on this, seeing as you speak to, like, throughout so many seminars and conferences with coaches, what are some of those philosophies or methodologies that you try to hit home in terms of having a proper mindset for an athlete in triathlon? I'm just kind of curious, do you have any tips on that?
Yeah. Mindset is actually, once the athlete's got a training plan laid out and knows all this other stuff we talked about, for example, nutrition, how they're going to measure workouts, intensity especially, what the durations are going to be, what the TSS is going to be, all this kind of stuff. Once we've got this all laid out, really the only thing that's standing between the athlete and success now is what's going on between their ears. That's the biggest, greatest reason why athletes succeed or fail, in the most part, is because of their mindset. Every athlete, I don't care who it is, the best athlete, you know, Jan Frodeno or whoever it may be, the best athletes in the world and the worst athletes in the world are still lack confidence. Everybody lacks confidence. We're just talking about how great this lack of confidence is. Unfortunately, sometimes the novice has less lack of confidence because they don't understand what they're getting into than does the experienced pro who's been around for a long time. But everybody realizes that there are things that stand between them and success, and what they have to do is somehow overcome this mindset that they may not be able to do it. They've got to convince themselves that they can. That can be a very difficult conversation to get that through. Every athlete will try to make it look as if they're confident, that they have no problems whatsoever. But I can guarantee you that down deep, every one of them has a confidence issue going on at some degree. And so, you know, I've worked with athletes over the years on things like this. And one of the things that I did with athletes who I realized this was really a problem for them was I would tell them, for example, one thing they would do is when they would go to bed at night, every night, and they would turn the lights out, there's maybe, let's say, 10 minutes or so before they fall asleep, hopefully. Let's use that 10 minutes to our advantage. So I would have my athletes go back and find one thing they did that day in their training that they thought was good. Doesn't have to be great, just good. One thing they thought really went well. It could have been they climbed one hill on their bike really well that day, or they did an interval set on the track and it went very well, whatever it may be. But they relive that thing over and over and over until they fall asleep. The idea being that we want to get it into their heads that, yes, I can do things that are good. So over time, what will happen is over the course of several nights, days, weeks, months, years even, the athlete will build up this reservoir of all these successes they've had in training over time, so that when they get to that starting line and this voice in their head says, you know, you're really not that good, this is going to be really difficult for you and you may not make it. When that little voice pops up, first thing the athlete should do is go back and find the biggest one of those experiences they had in their training and getting ready for this race. Go back and relive that again. Remember that day I did that workout? And it was the hardest workout I've ever done in my life. And I did it. I did a great workout. I survived it. And remember, so you've got this reservoir now of successes. You have to go back and relive those successes again. Go back and find them again and pull them back up, because that little voice is trying to try to convince you that you can't do it. And you've got to overcome that somehow with the idea, you know, you can do it because you've done these sorts of things before. It's not new. It's just a new challenge to you, but you've lived up to this challenge before in other ways. So now we've got to go back and make sure that we understand that, so we can be ready for when that race starts, and then remind ourselves throughout the race, yes, I've done this before and I can do it again. So it's not easy. It requires an awful lot of time by the athlete. It's really good if that athlete has somebody in their corner who understands sports psychology, who can help them get through these mental devils that keep popping up. But that is a very valuable thing. And I'm glad you brought that up because it's one of the most important things an athlete can get right in their training is getting the mental side ironed out.
Awesome. No, I love that. And actually, that's a really great exercise before falling asleep is, you know, instead of what I think most of us tend to do is, you know, check our phones, set our alarm clocks and just kind of be stuck to social media right before we fall asleep, which is already bad for our, you know, seeing the blue light before bed. But instead, you know, taking those 10 minutes prior to falling asleep and just, you know, creating that reservoir of confidence over time. So I really like that exercise. I think every listener should definitely try that because I'll definitely start incorporating that into my training myself too. So that's excellent. Appreciate that. And that's amazing. I mean, I just kind of want to end off with one last simple question here, I guess, for any new listeners out there who are, you know, this year or, you know, maybe it's a new year resolution or something's coming up and they're going to be doing their first triathlon next year. Is there any advice to new triathletes out there just getting into the sport? What would it be that you'd want to sort of pass on to them?
Yeah, a couple of things. One, as I've already mentioned, that is your goal if you're new to the sport is to finish the race. That's the number one goal. And secondly, become very aware of your pacing and don't get carried away at the early part of the bike leg of the race. It's typical for an athlete at the start of the bike leg to all of a sudden think they're Superman or Superwoman and they can do things beyond what they've ever done before in training. And it's unlikely that'll happen. What is more likely is they'll wind up going anaerobic or going extremely hard. And you wind up, because of that, they limp back home on the bike and they wind up walking the run portion of the race. So it all comes down to the start of the bike. Athletes tend to screw that up the newer they are to the sport.
Awesome. No, that's perfect. And I think that's some solid advice too, because I think, yeah, you know, a lot of athletes can probably think back to their early days who are experienced and they can probably recall, you know, one, if not multiple races that they were in and gave it all on the bike and had nothing left on the run. So I think that's excellent. Just, you know, keeping that paced so you have enough for the back end. So awesome. That's perfect. And you know what? I think that's a great spot to end things off. And obviously, I'm sure I keep going all day here, but I'm sure you got a busy rest of the day here planned. So I won't keep you here any longer. But I guess before we end this off, where can the listeners go to find out more about all your book series? Do you have a website or social media? Or?
Yeah, I've got a blog. It's called joefreeolsblog.com. And I've got 7, so there are hundreds of articles I've written there on how to train for various types of things. I just posted a new one yesterday, in fact. And that also lists all my books and shows, gives you the links so you can purchase them and other stuff besides that.
Awesome. No, that's amazing. And thanks so much for giving us all this information and knowledge today. And I'm sure it's definitely resonated with a lot of listeners and in the process. So hopefully we gain some, few new Training Peak users along the way here. So appreciate that and all the best.
Thanks, Stephen, very much. I enjoyed talking with you.
Awesome. Take care. Well, guys, there you have it. The coach of coaches, Mr. Joe Freel. So thanks so much for listening in, guys. I really hope you enjoyed that episode like I did. And that's a wrap. So if you want to hear more podcasts like these, then hit that subscribe button and you can follow me on Instagram at pacing.and.racing. And you can check us out on YouTube by searching Pacing and Racing. And lastly, if you did like this episode, please just take 2 minutes to leave a kind review on the podcast channel as it helps us get heard by more listeners through the podcast platform algorithms. Anyways, thanks so much. We'll talk to you next time.